Welcome to Mormonland, the Salt Lake Tribune's podcast about all things Mormon. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, here with managing editor Dave Noyes. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jennifer.
And today we're talking Mormon finances. I think it's fair to say that today's LDS church is considered to be a flush and flourishing empire. But historian D. Michael Quinn says it hasn't always been so. He traces the church's up and down financial history in a new book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. He is a scholar and author of several books, including the Mormon Hierarchy series and Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. He's in Salt Lake City this week and is joining us here in the newsroom. And Mike, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for the offer.
We should say from the outset that you were excommunicated from the LDS Church, and yet this book is not, it's not super critical.
I don't think it's a critical at all.
About the church's corporate structure. In fact, you say that it could be viewed as faith-promoting.
Yes.
Explain why.
Well, I think that we're looking at an 180-year trajectory of Mormonism, and I'm emphasizing in the book finances and business. And for me, it's American success story without parallel. Aside from the really financially strapped poverty position of most of the members and leaders in the early years, the confiscation of the church's assets from 1887 to 1896 was a huge blow to the not only the finances and the business, but also to the self-definition of Mormons who had been in conflict with the federal government for decades. And then after those funds were returned after statehood in 1896, about every 20 to 30 years, the church moved financially for a variety of reasons to the edge of bankruptcy. And the last time this occurred was in the early 1960s, when by 1963, the financial officers at church headquarters in Salt Lake City didn't think they'd be able to pay the payroll of their own employees. And that was how desperate the situation was. They had, as is often the case in corporate bankruptcies, they had a lot of assets, but they were fixed assets. It was land and other items that could not be converted immediately into cash to meet immediate obligations, like a payroll. So from that point forward, the transition came into the hands of N.L. Dentanner, who was Canadian-born, very successful businessman in Canada, already a millionaire by the time he became a counselor in the first presidency in 1963. And he transformed church finances and began the recovery of the church from this brinkism financial that had occurred repeatedly, and put it on a solid financial basis, including a transference to very high-level stock investments. And the progress of that was such that by 1969, the church was in a completely stable financial situation. And then the trajectory of a church in investments and for-profit businesses became steadily upward.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we are looking at now, that kind of experience. There's no church, there's no business, there's no nonprofit that has had that kind of experience, going from confiscation of all assets by the federal government to now a church of multi-billions in wealth.
We're going to get into some of those episodes in a little bit more depth as we go, but this is such an ambitious project, and I understand you've been intrigued with church finances for decades. Where does this obsession come from?
Well, it started with a graduate paper for a course at the University of Utah when I was a starting master's student.
And you don't have to say how old you are now.
No, but I'm 73, so that, you know, no concealing that. But as this, I had just come out of the military after 3 years of service, and had decided to switch from English literature, which had been my original career intent, and switch to history, which had always been a hobby for me, but I decided to professionalize it. And this class taught us about which were new at the time in the academy, academic emphasis on history. And one of them was group biography. And that intrigued me. And the course was a two-term course at the U. And the second term was our working primarily on a 30 to 50 page paper for this class, choosing one of these methods. And I chose the method of group biography. And the group I chose was a group I had become familiar with already through research and reading, and that was the General Authorities of the LDS Church. So I had to pick a time period, and probably foolishly, I picked the first century of their involvement in being the highest leaders of the LDS Church. So I was looking from the period of the 1830s to the 1930s, and I looked at initially their birth and where they grew up and their education and their prior religious experience for those who converted to Mormonism. And then by 1975, I added finances to the study that I was then continuing to do for a PhD at Yale University. And that continued to grow, and then I'd get diverted on another assignment or teaching at the history department at Brigham Young University. And so I typically would work on it a couple of years every decade, a couple of years in the 80s, a couple of years in the 90s. And then by 2008, I was finally free of other commitments and decided that I was going to work full time on it. And
that's still another 9 years of dedication.
Yeah, that's
intense.
True. And the reason was that I had originally wanted to publish only essentially an appendix, what is now in the book Appendix 5. And my publisher of the previous books in the Hierarchy series was Signature Books. And its managing editor, Ron Prittis, said, "Nothing doing. We're not going to publish just an appendix. It's interesting, but you're going to have to do a complete book." And I moaned and groaned and said I didn't want to go back to this. I was tired of it and didn't want to put the energy into new research. And he said, "Well, that's fine. We're not going to publish your appendix.
Take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it." And so after kicking and screaming for a while, I finally decided that I was going to do a real book. And then I decided, well, since it's coming out in the 21st century, everyone will ask, "Oh, why don't you bring it up to the 21st century?" And so that's what I decided to do. And that's one reason it took so long, because I had not looked at anything really past, financially, past the 1980s.
Well, now, the church used to report its finances, like in general conference. When did that stop, and why did they stop doing it?
Yes, they had started as an organization publishing an annual report in the 1800s, and that really, in a detailed way, started happening in the 1850s. And every April conference, there was a report read. But these weren't published. They were read to those who attended. And so the people who chose not to or could not attend the annual conference in April didn't know the financial details that were read there verbally. And the financial reports on a regular basis didn't start being read to the General Conference until the 20th century, the early 1900s. And in 1915, you had a detailed financial report for the first time given at April Conference, which gave the tithing received during the previous year, as well all of the expenditures during the previous year, which ate up every penny of the tithing received. And that was the only time in the 20th century that the annual report included tithing received. And I think there's a misunderstanding among people who knew that the reports went until 1959. They think that included tithing. That was only the first year in 1915. And so from 1915 onward, those annual reports, which were read at General Conference, but also published for the public to look at, they included expenditures, and they would categorize them in different areas, give totals of those expenditures. And that kind of financial report was most detailed during the 1940s, and I give a full example of the 1949 report, which went on for, in the published version the church put out as a pamphlet, 15 pages. And you can imagine them reading to this congregation of about 8,000 to 10,000 people, full of children and teenage girls and boys. It had to have taken 15 minutes to read that much financial, dreary financial information. But they did it. And the last of those reports, although shortened, was in April 1959, and no financial reports have been given since then.
So how'd you do that book then, if you don't have financials?
Well, the advantage that I had was there was a period of time in the early 1970s when, as an employee of the historical department and as a writer research on the staff of Leonard Arrington, I had access to anything I asked for that they could find. And so that included the annual reports of the presiding bishopric, which included pages and pages and far more than I was interested in, of details about sources of income and expenditures of income. And so I was able to have the statistics of annual income down to 1962. And then that allowed me in a statistical progression to estimate the what the annual income of tithing would be from 1960 to 2010. And I based that on the annual growth of tithing during the 1950s, which I felt was a conservative measure of tithing increase to the church, because in the 1950s, the church began sending missionaries, began building buildings and temples in war-torn Europe, which was still recovering and rebuilding after the war, and in war-torn Asia, and in Latin America, where in every country in Latin America, 1% of the population owned 80 or 90% of the wealth of that country. And so the converts who were coming in were not from the high 1%. They were coming in from the lower, which there was no significant middle class in Latin America in the 1850s. And so I felt that this period was fairly conservative measure of tithing increase. And so that's what I used as my measure for projecting from 1960 forward. And I found that my projections were conservative because I had the tithing income for 1961 and for 1962. And compared to my statistical projections, what my projections were for those years were significantly below with the actual tithing that came in those years. So that gave me confidence.
So what did you put the tithing at in 2010? What did you estimate using this statistical analysis and the baseline history?
$33 billion
a year
of tithing, yes, in 2013. Now, that's not total income because the total revenue also includes commercial income. And for that, I had to estimate based on what I knew from previous. In 1901 and 1902, when the church was not in great financial shape, it was still paying off the debts that it had from the confiscation and from business failures in the 1890s. At that point, the commercial income equaled 17% of the church's total income. 17% on top of tithing. In the 1928 report that I had access to, the commercial income at that point equaled 29%, so it had grown significantly. Then under Eldon Tanner, commercial, as I pointed out, commercial income and investments became much more stabilized, much more profitable. And in 1960s and in the late 1960s and the mid 1970s, he told reporters for financial newspapers and magazines that the church's income was just over 50% of the church's total revenue in terms of tithing. So I estimated that, again, I felt it was conservative, that that meant 40 to 45% of the total annual revenues in the 1960s and 70s were coming from commercial paper or the portfolio, stocks and bonds, and then for-profit businesses, and the church had both as commercial income. And the rule financially of N. Eldon Tanner over the church's finances continued until his death in 1982. And from everyone I've spoken to at church headquarters, the priorities, the methods, that and also the risk avoidance that he established during that period of nearly 20 years has continued to govern church finances to the present. So I think, you know, at a minimum, I think that the estimates that some at church headquarters have given that commercial income is 5 or 10%, I just don't think are realistic in view of it being 17% in 1901 and 29% in 1928. And Nen Olden Tanner estimating between 40 and 45% in the 1960s and 70s. So I think that conservatively and reasonably in terms of that those past amounts that you can verify, that I think you'd need to add about $15 billion of commercial income to the amount of $33 billion tithing for 2010. So it's coming, it's pushing. And I think this is conservative. It's pushing $50 billion with a B of total income to the LDS Church in 2010. However, a lot of that is going out in expenditures to support the work of the church. And you may want to ask about that.
So you're talking about that's the income that's coming income. In from different places. Tithing still accounts for more?
Oh, yes. Tithing, I'm sure that pattern that N. Eldon Tanner indicated, more than 50%, is coming from tithing. But then, my conclusion when I looked at the International Church's financial records was that the growth of the International Church would not be possible without the commercial income that investments and for-profit businesses bring.
So bottom line, what would you put the church's total worth at?
Well, that's a difficult question because you have to look at net assets. And so many of the fixed assets of the LDS Church, land and buildings, are consuming money. They're not producing money. Mm-hmm. And they're consuming it in multiple ways. First, before the land is used for construction, actual digging the foundation of a religious building, that land is not tax exempt, even though it's intended for a religious purpose. The IRS and state and local tax agencies do not exempt an intention. If you own the land, it doesn't matter what your intent for it is, if it's not being used for a tax exempt purpose. And so the land that the church owns that is essentially empty is taxable.
So it's paying taxes on that.
It's paying taxes on
that. That's in the U.S., although, of course, things vary across the world, too.
Across the world, it varies, but I can't believe that tax exemptions would be greater outside the United States. I think they're very liberal in the United States. Then after a building is constructed on that land, the land itself is tax exempt, but then the church is pouring cash into the costs of construction, and then furnishing a building before it is complete and ready for occupancy and use. And then after that is completed and the building is dedicated, and it's only dedicated under LDS Church rules and traditions going back more than a century, it's dedicated only after it has been completely paid for. And so then Then you have maintenance. You have janitors. You have, in some cases, security officials who are working on a sometimes 24-hour basis to preserve against any kind of vandalism or other damage to those properties and those buildings in particular. And then you have all the electricity and all of the other kinds of maintenance, but you don't have taxes, because once a building is designated exclusively for religious purposes under U.S. tax law, in every state of the union, it is exempt. However, that does not apply to even welfare programs of the LDS Church, which sell their commodities on the open market, because then they're in competition with the general economy. And so even though a portion of those projects on welfare farms and canneries and many other things are devoted to exclusively to the poor, the products, the produce, whether it's agricultural or the products in terms of manufacturing, such as clothing or whatever else, are then, if they're sold on the open market, those are subject in almost every state of the union to taxes. And so a lot of money is going out. And in the international church, Canada is the least dependent on additional subsidies from Salt Lake City. There are years when Canada has no boost. Its tithing during the year is able to pay for all of its expenses. But that isn't always true. And the highest that I found in the 21st century that Canada received as a bump from church headquarters was 6% of its expenditures, which, you know, is in the millions. And then in the United Kingdom, which is an industrial first world country under the old Cold War designation of first world, second world, third world, the UK has received an average of 40 to 60% annually. And in 2006, LDS headquarters gave nearly half a billion dollars. It was 400,000 and change to supplement the tithing that was collected from British members that could not pay for the expenses of the church in the UK. And that's another, you know, in an industrial nation. In the Philippines, which is by the old Cold War definitions a third world country, by 21st definitions is a developing country, between 90 to 98% of its expenditures cannot be paid by Filipinos paying tithing, because their incomes on average are not able to put any more than one meal a day on the table for each member of their family. They cannot support the building of chapels and temples in Hawaii and the Philippines. And so LDS headquarters pays between 90 to 98% of their expenses. And that's cash outlay from headquarters to the Philippines. And that's true for the other developing countries that I was able to look at. And I have no reason to expect that it would be untrue in developing countries throughout the world. And the church has temples and chapels throughout Latin America, which is all of those countries are defined as developing, throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Again, those are developing countries and whose people could not afford to pay for their wooden and structure and concrete buildings, and certainly not their temples and their administrative buildings. And so my conclusion is that even though people who are believing Mormons may be uncomfortable with an expenditure such as $1.5 billion for the City Creek Center, the profits from commercial enterprises make possible the growth of the church in international realm.
And another point that you brought up that I find so surprising, you have this really wealthy church, and yet its leadership, the money's not flowing into their pockets, really.
No, this is typically the exceptions to this were two members of the same family, Brigham Young and his son, John W. Young, in the pioneer era of Utah, had enormous wealth. And they were the exceptions, and Brigham Young was making those financial decisions that benefited him and his son. And he made it very clear to the members of the church in the sermons that were published that he felt that because of his saving the church from disaster more than one time, he deserved about the equal value of finances as the church itself had. Mm. And that was Brigham's point of view, but that ended after his death. And
you had a fascinating table, I think it's from a probate record,
right,
that showed what Brigham Young had at that time, and you translated it to what it would be worth today.
Right.
And the figures are stark as you look at the other list.
Yeah, stark.
On the list.
I mean, he was a millionaire in 1877's time, and that was a time when there were very few millionaires. He was on par with what that time period it was called the robber barons of the West Coast and the East Coast, who were making also millions of dollars and had these wonderful mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, and elsewhere. That was not usual. His ex-successors, for example, died with estates that were less than a tenth of the value of his. And when I compare these estates, you can't really compare on an equal basis an estate for a man who died 10 years before or 100 years before a person who died with an estate appraisal, because the value of the dollar varies dramatically year to year and certainly decade to decade. So what I did was I took all of these values of the probate estate assessments by independent estimators and or appraisers was their term, and converted them to $2,010 dollars. And then I was able to compare Brigham Young with everyone else, and no one ever achieved the value of his estate.
And Brigham Young's was 35
45 billion.
Yes, yeah, like 40, million.
45 million.
Million.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Million of his estate in 2010 dollars. What stunned me? That was something I expected, but my anticipation was that all the general authorities were going to have a kind of a stratified value of their estates, and I expected all the presidents of the church to be at the top, and that everyone else would be in $2,010 dollars below. What stunned me was finding that a president of the church that many of us old people are still alive to remember, David O. McKay, in comparative dollars, died with an estate that was lower than 21 lower-ranking general authorities who died when their estates are compared to $2,010 dollars. That would never have occurred to me. And that also was true of his predecessor, George Albert Smith, that about 50 general authorities, lower-ranking men in the leadership of the church, died with greater wealth than President George Albert Smith when compared in $2,010 dollars. Now, an avid businessman like Heber J. Grant, that was not the case. He died with a very large estate in 1945, about $400,000, and that was a lot of money, even in 1945, and in $2,010 dollars, it's a lot of money. But he was an exception because most of the presidents of the church, aside from Brigham Young, died with relatively modest incomes in their estates. And then I compared what I know as I can trace the salaries, and there really was no salary, or the preferred term among Mormons is allowance, living allowance, until 1877. And that's when Brigham Young's successor decided he was going to stop this whimsical decision of a president of the church whether you need the money that you're asking him for, and instead give a standard allowance to all of the general authorities. However, it was initially structured by your echelon in the hierarchy. The president of the church received the most each month, his counselors the next most, the senior apostles the next most, the junior apostles next most, then the presiding bishop the next most, his counselor is the next most. And as a presiding quorum, the 70s were kind of a third or fourth consideration financially. And the very lowest consistently by any measure from the death of Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith onward was the presiding patriarch. Or the patriarch to the
church. A position that no longer really exists.
It no longer exists. Right. It ended in 1979, but from 1845 until 1979, he was always at the bottom, despite the very lofty title that he had of presiding patriarch. And this disparity, which I call stratified salary system or allowance system, continued until after Heber J. Grant died. And he had already indicated a discomfort with the disparities, and he had increased the remuneration or the allowance to the patriarch to the church. His successor was so discomforted with it that he told in 1947 the financial secretary, lower my compensation so that it won't be the same with the lowest ranking member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. He clearly was discomforted by having a higher living allowance than most junior members of the Apostles. His successor, David O. McKay, was also obviously concerned with the disparities, and he made increases for young general authorities who had children under the age of adulthood. And he did that in the early 1960s. But then by 1966, his office diary indicates, and that is supported by the man who became the church's comptroller initially in 1966 and then became the director of the church finance department. David O. McKay equalized the compensation for all general authorities so that he, as church president, received no more a living allowance or a salary, as some could call it, than the newest member and the lowest ranking member of the hierarchy, I call it, or the general authorities. Now, even though from 1966 onward, their salaries were equalized, they were still receiving supplements, those who had the opportunity to be officers or directors of church-controlled or owned businesses. And these could be substantial. I verified that 78% of Heber J. Grant's income in various years was coming from his directorships and corporate officer in payments. And that was even true with somebody who was less interested in income than and business than as was his successor, George Albert Smith, who received about 40% of his income from these corporate directorships and officerships. Well, that ended for the first presidency in 1977 when they announced that they were withdrawing from these church-owned corporate and for-profit businesses. And then it ended for all the general authorities, with a few exceptions that I'll mention. But for-profit businesses, all the general authorities were withdrawn from being officers or directors. And the exceptions to that are the presiding bishopric, whose revelatory responsibility as well as traditional responsibilities have been financial. And so the members of the presiding bishopric, the presiding bishop and his counselors, three men altogether, have extensive positions as officers and directors of nonprofit as well as for-profit businesses owned or controlled by the LDS Church. The president and his counselors retain some usually honorary officerships in some of the most important of those, but they are preoccupied to really have any hands-on control. And the few general authorities who do have and have had positions in for-profit businesses are generally limited to men who have become emeritus. And so they're not technically general authorities anymore, but they are have had a history as a general authority. And after their release, then they are appointed sometimes the president of a desert management corporation or other corporation that is involved in significant for-profit income of millions of dollars annually.
What you seem to praise as financial wizardry, other people find quite distasteful, the corporate structure of how the Mormon Church has developed. You mentioned the City Creek Center, and a lot that raised a lot of eyebrows, thinking, wow, that's a lot of money. Is that the correct role for a church, a spiritual institution? Is that the best place to put that money? So how do you defend that argument?
Well, there's a theology of Mormonism that is different from every other religious tradition I am aware of. In all the other religious traditions, the idea that a devout Muslim or a devout Jew or a devout Christian enters into business and says to himself and maybe to others, what I am doing commercially, I'm doing unto the Lord. And they see this as a part of their spiritual relationship with God. And that I call a bottom up. That's a from the individual saying to God, I am doing this for you. But in the Mormon revelations that Joseph Smith, the founder of the church, announced beginning in August 1830, just a few months after the church was organized, a revelation has God saying, verily, everything I do and have ordered and commanded is spiritual. And there is no temporal spiritual divide. He says, I have never given a commandment in this revelation. The words of it say that I have never given a commandment which is temporal. All my commandments are spiritual. And from that point forward into the 1830s, you have revelations given in, Mormons can look them up in their Doctrine and Covenants, which contains these revelations, a revelation about the establishment of a tannery, a revelation about establishment of mills, of lumber, sawmills, and even in 1841 about establishing a hotel. And I think Orson Hyde, one of the founding apostles of the LDS Church who came to Utah, said in the 1860s, he expressed it best. He said over the pulpit to Salt Lake Mormons, when it comes to dollars and cents, that also is spiritual to us. And people have long been up concerned, uncomfortable with this merger of the financial and the spiritual, of the temporal and the spiritual in Mormon terms. But that is just a part of Mormonism. It has been from the 1830s to the present. And I have said, and without apology, that the business of Mormonism has always been business. For example, if you look at City Creek Center, when the LDS Church announced that it was building the Hotel Utah in 1910, it said that it was spending 2010 dollars, a century later, the equivalent of $14 million for upfront to open the Hotel Utah. And that's in 2010 dollars, and that was only for one hotel. When you look at the expenditure of the church for, they acknowledge $1.5 billion. For the City Creek Center, that rolls eyes, that causes consternation until you look at it in context. First of all, the church has always been a commercial operation. Second of all, God doesn't separate between the temporal and the spiritual, between dollars and cents and doing work for the dead or baptizing converts. It's all spiritual to God, according to revelations Joseph Smith published. And then the context of what the church is doing worldwide with this money that is both tithing and multi-billions annually of commercial income. In a single year, you compare 1.5 million or billion for the City Creek Center to what the church in the UK acknowledged as a nearly half a billion dollar supplement from church headquarters to that group of members of the church alone. And then you have 90% and higher subsidies for the developing world, each country of the developing world. And the church, if it gave the statement, even of its expenditures, as the church used to do throughout most of the 20th century, the membership of the church and non-Mormons would see billions and billions, multi-billions of dollars a year spent on welfare, on genealogy, on temples, on the missionary work, on the poor. And I wish that they, if they did such a report, they would separate what they give to the United States and Canada versus all the rest of the world. And anyone looking at even the bottom line figures, what they receive as tithing, which headquarters receives no tithing from the International Church because laws prohibit churches from giving their income outside the country. And also the church would lose money, even in a country that would allow the church in Ghana to transfer its tithing to Salt Lake. There would be a loss of exchange rate in the United States converting that to dollars, and then whatever they sent back to not Ghana would also lose money on an exchange rate. And so it would be foolish for the International Church to send its tithes to the United States. So a report that would separate out Canada and the United States, which neither one of them receive significant, if any, supplements, Canada doesn't, from church headquarters, compare that to every other country in the world, and even if it were a two-line statement for every other country in the world, there would be no tithing received from every other country in the world, and multi-billions a year given to support the church and its procedures and the poor and its programs and its building and its upkeep throughout the world. And then the Latter-day Saints and outsiders, which is the kindest term that Mormons can use for non-members of the church. There have been less kind terms used. That outsiders would also see, wow, this is a church that, although it's very wealthy, although it is involved in billions of dollars of income and expenditures in the commercial area, it is giving this money overwhelmingly for the benefit of the rank and file.
Any hope for that kind of transparency anytime soon?
Well, I think, and I'm not alone in this. I mean, if it were just me, just, you know, Mike Quinn, a socialist since my 20s, who doesn't have any objection to countries that allow billionaires, it's just everyone's boat should rise. No country should have poor. There should not be poverty in any country. But billionaires are fine with me, but as long as they share the wealth with the poor, and there is no poor. But I have no problem with the multi-billions the church is making in its commercial investments, and I have no problem in my, you know, rank and file life as barely making enough money to put bread on the table and keep an emergency fund in the bank at the best. But the former director of the financial department, J. Allen Blodgett, who was at one time the chief controller when he first started out with the church in the early 1960s, who became the director of the financial department of the church for all of his expenditures. He knew where all the income was coming from, where all the outlays were going. He knew all of the incomes that the general authorities were receiving from all sources. And at that time, he said in the 1980s, he was glad that he was making far more than the general authorities were receiving for their life work and 24/7 work, whereas he was an 8-to-5 guy as an employee of the church, and he was making far more than they were. But he also, and I quote him, saying this, that he feels that a full disclosure of the church's income from all sources and its expenditures in all departments and all areas would be faith-promoting. Because even though the numbers might initially stagger the viewer, seeing them in the billions, tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions total, that the expenditures of the church would show both outsiders and somewhat disheartened members of the church at the commercial side of the church would show that this money is overwhelmingly going for the benefit of the rank and file. And that, to me, it was staggering. It was something I had no anticipation of finding. Not only that 50 or so general authorities whose probates I had access to up until the mid-1980s were wealthier at death than two of the recent general authorities who were presidents of the church, George Albert Smith and David O. McKay. That was drop-jaw kind of discovery for me. But more so than that was when the release document, which was published by the Salt Lake Tribune in a wonderful article Peggy Fletcher Stack did about this evidence of financial compensation to the general authorities, in a 2014 document, it specified that the salary or the compensation, the allowance given to all the general authorities on an equal basis at that point was $120,000 a year.
That's from the top, from the president of the church to the lowest 70.
Anyone who, as a general authority, even if they're only in a 5 or 6 year calling, are devoting at that time their full time and effort 24/7 and are on call 24/7 from church headquarters. I mean, that old line that was heard frequently about a call phone call receiving at 3 o'clock in the morning. Many of the general authorities get those kinds of phone calls, and they are on the church scale sometimes as existential as that phone call that was being talked about at 3 o'clock in the morning during the presidential election. Anyway, they are receiving, as of 2014, $120,000 a year annual income. The 2010, 4 years earlier, report from Canada showed that its highest employee administrator in Canadian dollars, which is virtually the same within a few cents to American dollars, in 2010 was receiving more than double what the president of the church was receiving as compensation. That, to me, was totally unexpected. And this is, this is a high-ranking bureaucrat. And I mean, church administrator. I call it what it is, and it's a bureaucrat. And that top-ranking, salaried, hired, and could be fired bureaucrat is as of the early part of the 20th century, was being paid in Canada, and I'm sure that's true throughout the corporate structure, or not the corporate, but the bureaucratic structure of the church in the United States and throughout the world. The top administrators and the most skilled people within the bureaucracy who are receiving these high incomes are receiving twice as much as the president of the church does. And the president of the church and his first presidency counselors and the Quorum of the 12 are the ones who set those salaries. And they're allowing rank-and-file Mormons at the highest levels to be paid double what they receive as compensation for their 27 lifetime work, 24/7, compared to top bureaucrats and skilled bureaucrats who work 8 to 10 hours a day at most, have weekends off, aside from church work, and all these men are also devoting their service to church. To me, this is stunning and faith-promoting. And somebody pointed out, and I wish I had thought of comparing those compensations to nonprofit organizations. And I haven't double-checked this, but when I gave a book talk in San Francisco last week on this, one of the persons in attendance said, you know that the president of the Red Cross receives $1.2 million annually. And you compare this to the president of a multi-billion dollar organization who allows himself only $120,000 a year. And the Red Cross, which is nonprofit, is paying its chief CEO 10 times that amount. To me, there is no parallel. There is no parallel for me for the trajectory that the LDS Church has experienced from poverty to hand-in-mouth bankruptcy issues to where it is now. And there is no comparison to the volunteerism of the highest officers of the LDS Church compared to the highest officers of any nonprofit you can look at.
We clearly just scratched the surface of your encyclopedic memory here. I mean, this is an amazing project. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
The book is The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. You can sign up for the Mormon Land podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can read more about this book at sltrib.com. Thanks so much for tuning in this week.